Impeachment in context. What are your questions? This morning, the House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to advance two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. The two charges, abuse of power and obstruction of justice. The full House of Representatives is expected to vote next week, and if it votes to impeach, as is expected, the case goes to the U.S. Senate for a trial. Throughout the process, there are nuanced questions about what the U.S. Constitution spells out and how the process works. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will dig into those questions with historian and author Kenneth C. Davis, legal scholar Dimitri Baum, and Professor David House. What exactly does the Constitution say? Do senators face a different obligation than House members? What does impeachment mean for our democracy? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For the past few weeks and for the foreseeable future, American politics will be dominated by the impeachment of the president. Today, we're going to discuss constitutional law and the history of impeachment and how it applies to the current impeachment process. Joining me in the studio, Dimitri Baum. He is the interim dean at the University of Maine School of Law. His focus is constitutional law. Joining us from our Bangor studio, David House, Associate Professor of History at Husson University. He is also Director of Husson's Online and Extended Learning. And joining us from his home in New York City, Kenneth C. Davis. He is the best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series and the acclaimed In the Shadow of Liberty. His new book, Strong Man, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy, comes out in 2020. As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Do you have questions about the impeachment process? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all three of you, and thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be on Maine Calling today. Kenneth, you recently had an article in Smithsonian Magazine about the history of impeachment, and there's some interesting items in there that I think a lot of people don't know. And the first that strikes me is that Benjamin Franklin worried about the question of impeachment. You write, America's elder statesman feared that without a means to remove a corrupt or incompetent official, the only resort would be assassination.
This was a real question for those gentlemen back in 1787 as they sweated through the summer with the doors closed and locked and the windows shut because they didn't want anyone hearing. And of course, they came up with the constitutional approach to removing an official who was somehow either corrupt or malevolent. And they had borrowed this from some English law. And I will let the constitutional scholars deal with that more specifically, but just say that the events of today and probably in the next 2 weeks or so will probably confirm what Gerald Ford as a congressman said in 1970, forgive me, that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at a given moment in history. That has pretty much been the case when we talk about presidential impeachment and certainly seem to be bearing out right now.
Dimitri, what does the Constitution actually say?
Well, it says the president can be removed for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And, you know, I think at the convention, everyone agreed there should be some removal standard. There was some debate about what that should be. You know, George Mason, one of the founding fathers, suggested maladministration, something a little more broad and open-ended. The framers ultimately agreed to this constitutional language. But, you know, I agree there's not a clear, bright-line standard that we can point to and say, all right, this checks the box. We know for sure this meets the bar. That's why we have these debates about what is a high crime and misdemeanor.
All right. I'm going to let you, David, take it from there. What is a high crime and misdemeanor?
That is a concept that's subject to the interpretation of the House as they see fit at that time in the first phase, and then the Senate ultimately when presented articles of impeachment. That was left fairly broad and open, recognizing that they were pursuing, you know, the founders when they wrote this, ultimately agreed that what they had in there was you're not necessarily looking at an actual crime, that there may be other abuses of authority that aren't necessarily listed as an actual crime in a criminal code, but would rise to the level of some sort of abuse of power or the office of the presidency. And this is a generation of individuals who were very concerned about the abuses of executive power. They felt that that was what they had witnessed in King George III and in creating their state and governments and then the Constitution. What they were looking at is some mechanism to ensure they're against the misuse of power or abuse of power by an executive.
What strikes me, Ken Davis, when we look back through the history of impeachments of presidents is that we went more than 100 years after Andrew Johnson before this was there was another impeachment. Has the way that our democracy thinks about impeachment changed in modern history?
I think to a degree it has. Specifically, I'm going to set aside the potential impeachment of Richard Nixon because, as we probably all know but should point out clearly, Nixon was about to be impeached. The Judiciary Committee voted then on several articles of impeachment. It never went to the House because Nixon was presented with this by some Republican congressmen, and that was the moment, of course, at which he chose to resign rather than risk the chance of impeachment and then removal, which was fairly likely given the circumstances. The circumstances changed greatly, of course, with Bill Clinton's impeachment. I just want to go back for just a moment to say also that impeachment isn't just presidential, and we should point that out, that this applies to figures, federal offices, including judges, and the large majority of impeachments, and including those that have led to an actual removal, have been for judges. So that's, we tend to think about it as presidential impeachment. It tends to be much broader than that. And this one more point, and there's a lot to get through here, so I don't want to dominate, but when they talked about this idea of removing the president, they understood very clearly that this was a really, really big deal. We've heard this idea thrown around in the past few years, you're overturning election, and in a sense, that certainly is. But the constitutional mechanism for doing so is there. But that is why the bar is set so high for removal with the two-thirds majority in the Senate.
Go ahead, Dimitri.
And the framers did say it would be a very rare remedy. So, I mean, I do agree with you that I think the standard has been evolving as we become more and more partisan in recent years. And so I think even looking at some presidents who weren't impeached, you know, there were conversations with Jackson, with Polk. So even early in our history about sanctioning the president, reprimanding the president. But I think as we become more and more partisan, you see how important it is to have control over the House and the Senate. You see this with judicial appointments, that whoever controls the Senate really has much more power to appoint judges they want. And we see that here with impeachment as well.
You know, David, I think go ahead, David. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think the other element that you have is you have many more tools to access information.
Mm.
So the other thing is that you also have an electorate as well, at, you know, presenting information on a, you know, a more rapid and immediate basis than you did in the past. And so even some things like phone calls or conversations, they can be recorded. There's more ways for that news to get out and to circulate and become issues that are on the public mind.
I want to talk a little bit process here. Kenneth, did you want to jump in? Go ahead.
I did want to jump in because just another thought on this, because it's maybe a little bit bigger picture than we want to go here, but I think that this is part of a fundamental change in our, you know, some very basic democratic institutions in this country, particularly in the past 30 years. You know, we went 200 years and only three times was there a popular winner in the election who lost in the Electoral College, 1824, 1876, 1888. Well, now it's happened twice in 16 years. I think that speaks to, you know, the sense of the partisanship in the country having changed, and this is not something that happened in a few years. We do see things like the Citizens United, the voter suppression movements, the gerrymandering by both parties over a long period of time, and I think that that has led to a bit of the cynicism and the hyper-partisanship that has that also goes into this moment and this impeachment.
I want to get a couple sort of process questions about where we are. So this morning, the House Judiciary Committee voted to advance the articles of impeachment, and the full House is expected to do so next week. Dimitri, when this goes to the Senate, which is sort of loosely described as the trial part of the impeachment process, how is the way that a senator who is going to be judge and jury, from my understanding, thinking about impeachment the same or different from how a House member is thinking about it? Is there a different standard for House members and for senators?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the design of the system, there may have been envisioned a different standard where the House basically acts as the prosecutor, you know, they manage the case. And so it's more like an indictment. And then you have the senators more like the jurors who are maybe more impartial, right? And the design was for the senators to be maybe a little bit more removed from popular politics. They have 6-year terms, and they're a little more isolated from the people. I think today that notion doesn't really play out that way. I mean, I think we have lost this idea of separation of powers and even checks and balances within the legislature. We now have very strong parties, and so I suspect the senators will see the case as highly political, just as political as the House does. And we've been hearing about Mitch McConnell working closely with the president's lawyers to try to coordinate a trial strategy. So there isn't much of a different role here. Both the House and the Senate see it as a political deliberation rather than a trial with a neutral jury.
Going to you, David, Dimitri mentions that the House manages the case. What does that mean? Just get our heads around what it's going to look like to have a House managing the case in the Senate.
Sure. So the House will have a team of individuals with their counsel who will present the impeachment almost like a prosecution would in a court case. The president is allowed to have counsel representing him as his defense. The Senate sits as the jury, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides over the trial. Questions have to be ordered. So they come from those key representatives in order to maintain a sense of order. And that process is written in the Senate manual. So that one of the sets of rules the Senate has actually spells out what the procedure is in the case of impeachment. So the Constitution is pretty broad, and the Senate and the House have drawn up their own sets of rules. And those rules will govern what happens. Those are the ground rules that the Senate has agreed to beforehand. And so in that case, the House has a team, much like, so for example, in the case of Andrew Johnson, Thaddeus Stevens, and other members of the House served as the prosecution, the representatives of the House, and they presented the case.
What is the standard of proof? Is it the same as in a criminal trial?
Well, it's ultimately up to each senator to decide, you know, do they believe there's been a high crime or misdemeanor committed? So, you know, it's while we think of it as a trial, it's not exactly, the same kind of trial that we'd see in the courtroom. Right. So it's up to each individual to set the standard in their own minds.
So there isn't a line.
There isn't a bright line. You know, there's not a ton of precedent here, and there's a lot of discretion built in for the Senate. You know, the Constitution says the Senate has the sole power to try these impeachments. And we know when there's an impeachment of a judge, Nixon, Walter Nixon, you know, he objected that he was only tried by a part of the Senate, not the full Senate. And the Supreme Court said, that's out of our hands. The Senate,
so there's
Senate
no
decides.
Appeal.
There's really no appeal, no. Right? The Supreme Court has basically said the Senate decides what's a trial. They can decide their own rules. If they call witnesses, they can call witnesses. If they don't, they don't have to.
Kenneth Davis. Go ahead. David.
No, I'm sorry. And that is in the Constitution, just as it says, you know, impeachment, the articles of impeachment, that is the sole power of the House. The trial is the sole power of the Senate.
Kenneth,
I would just add one point quickly. You said judge and jury, but the tradition now, of course, is also that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in this case John Roberts, does have a role that is somewhat ceremonial, but it's still a role that he will be sitting there and overseeing this this process. And so that's part of the mix as well that we should point out here.
That's right. Vice President Pence will not preside if there's a tiebreaker vote because of the obvious conflict of interest, correct?
Well, there can't be a tiebreaker here, right? Because if you get to the two-thirds threshold, he's impeached. If you don't get to it, he's not impeached. So you can't have kind of your standard 50-50 split where somebody has to break a tie.
Okay, but Pence will not be voting. He will not be part of this.
He's got a bit of a conflict of interest in being involved.
That's right. Ken Davis, we're hearing the word unprecedented thrown around a lot. I'm sure you've been hearing it. Are the charges against President Trump, in your view, unprecedented?
Well, many people have pointed out that some of the these charges mirror some of the charges that were put into the impeachment document that was prepared for Richard Nixon, and some as well for the impeachment of Bill Clinton in terms of the obstruction issue. So, yes, not unprecedented in that sense, I would say. What is a little bit different here is the process that's gotten us to this point, and not being critical of it one way or another, the fact that we did not have, we all remember if we are a certain of age, sitting through the Watergate summer and watching those hearings. And it was, you know, right out there. In many ways, we had a similar sense of the Clinton impeachment. Now, we still have the actual impeachment process, the House, the Senate hearing to go through, the Senate trial. So I think that might, you know, crystallize some of this for a lot of people. And, you know, it's really is a historic moment for the nation. We haven't done this a lot of times. So that does always lead to a sense of this is unprecedented because it's not something we do typically.
We are talking about the impeachment process, trying to put it in historical context and also get our heads around what might come next. If you have a question, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Health, a network of hospitals, healthcare providers, and specialists built with your needs at the very center. MaineHealth.org. Toad & Co., sustainable apparel and curated goods for the adventure that is life. Committed to living well and doing good in downtown Freeport, Maine. And Evergreen Subaru, announcing its Share the Love hometown charity, Sandcastle Clinical and Educational Services. EvergreenSubaru.com.
After weeks of televised impeachment testimony, Democrats and Republicans in Washington have become more entrenched in party messaging.
Impeachment won't be the central argument in this election.
What will it mean for 2020? That's next time on The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRX.
The Takeaway is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Saturday morning, the latest on the impeachment of Donald Trump. What to expect as we watch history. Also, what's next for the UK? Shrinking the minor leagues. And Asian comedian destroys America.
Good comedy is edgy, but if you're going to play with dynamite, you better be spot on, right? Otherwise, you're going to blow yourself up and get into a lot of trouble.
Ronnie Chiang and the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And that's tomorrow morning at 8 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answers to your questions about the impeachment process. Joining me, Dimitri Baum, who is a constitutional scholar and interim dean at the University of Maine School of Law. David House is associate professor of history at Husson University and director of Husson's Online and Extended Learning. And Kenneth C. Davis is the best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About History series. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to Garrett on Facebook. He writes, and we've answered a couple of these, but I'll read it anyway. What powers does the Senate have in the trial? Who prosecutes the case? Who defends it? Can they compel testimony? What happens if someone refuses to testify? David, I'm going to toss this to you. Can the Senate compel testimony? And if someone refuses to testify, what happens?
Yes, they can compel testimony. And if you refuse, you can be held in contempt of Congress or of the Senate. And, there is always the right to protect yourself against self-incrimination. So there is that potential, but the short answer is in the Senate rules, Congress does have the power to subpoena and compel testimony.
And we mentioned that the House prosecutes the case. Dimitri, who defends it?
Well, the president's attorney has the right to present evidence, right? So he can just kind of appoint somebody to represent that side. The Clinton impeachment, it was, I think, Cheryl Mills. But he had a big team of lawyers who represented them at that time as well.
All right. We'll go to Constantino calling from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. My question is, it's really a theoretical one, I suppose. As early as this morning, Senator McConnell was saying on NPR that he's going to work closely with White House counsel about the upcoming hearing. Now, if he's part of the jury, doesn't that raise eyebrows that he's working with the president's White House counsel? And what does Chief Justice John Roberts say about that?
Well, that's the point I was kind of mentioning earlier about in the design. I think there was the idea that the Senate and the House would try to protect their power against executive overreach. And I think, that's the idea behind checks and balances. I think today we just don't see it that way. So there's nothing unusual about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party kind of banding together in the House and the Senate and the presidency working together to the extent their partisan interests are aligned to come up with a strategy. So that's why I don't think of this as a trial in the same way as you think of a criminal prosecution, a criminal trial where jurors really must be independent. You would never imagine, a jury working together with the prosecutor or with a defendant to try to come up with a strategy for a case. This is a kind of a hybrid of politics and the Constitution or law.
And Kenneth, in the past, in past impeachment trials, has the president worked closely with Senate leaders?
We can't look at Nixon because there was no impeachment, and it was already clear that Nixon did not have the support of the Republican senators. In the case of Bill Clinton, I don't think there was the degree of open cooperation that the Senate Majority Leader came out and basically said that they were talking to the White House counsel. And so it was a remarkable moment, I think. Many commentators have said that the Senate is supposedly taking an oath of impartiality, and this seems to fly in the face of that. I don't know if that is a constitutional oath or not. Maybe one of the other scholars can say. I just wanted to add one kind of delicious piece of history here, because you mentioned Vice President Pence. In the first impeachment trial in the Senate, which was Justice Chase, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court did not preside, but Aaron Burr, who was the Vice President at the time, did preside, and he had just previously, of course, killed Alexander Hamilton, the former Secretary of the Treasury. So history is far more interesting than just about any fiction that we can come up with. And Burr was openly praised for the way he had conducted this impeachment trial, and Chase was ultimately acquitted.
Andrew on Facebook writes, given the deep partisan divide, this impeachment will not result in a conviction, so life will go on for the president. Projecting forward, let's speculate that he wins re-election, then goes on to his second term to commit something even more egregious. Once a first impeachment has run its course, could a sitting president be impeached a second time? What other remedies could be sought to deal with him if that were the case? David?
Yes. So as long as the House can pass other articles of impeachment, if they find other abuses of authority or other allegations that they believe there's compelling evidence supporting. Now, at the same time, the reality of that is, you know, they're not going to go down the same road again. So this would be related to new charges. Now, there is the option of censuring, which has been mentioned by a few policymakers and members of the Congress. The idea is that the Congress would show extreme disapproval of presidential actions. And this would be a simple resolution agreed to by the Congress. But that's not necessarily, you know, that doesn't have the same weight as impeachment, but that is another option it has. It doesn't require any punishment or follow-up. It's not really in the Constitution, but it is something in their toolbox. And I did want to mention, you know, the other impeachment the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. The Senate did not work closely with the president because they just really couldn't stand each other.
Yeah, it's important to remember that this is not a criminal prosecution, right? So a lot of these ideas of double jeopardy and right to cross-examine, you know, those don't apply, right? So we've heard this kind of complaint from the president that, you know, I want to confront my witness and due process. Mm-hmm. Those are principles that we think of, take very seriously in criminal prosecutions, but an impeachment is neither criminal nor civil. So certainly you could have new impeachment filings, charges filed, and it again becomes a political process of would you be able to get whatever the new constitution of the Senate is to go along.
Andrew, thanks for your post. We're going to go to Mark, who's
Jennifer,
calling. Yeah, go ahead, Kenneth.
If I could just jump in, because just on the history again, the Senate has only censured one president. It was in 1834. It was Andrew Jackson. It was over the fight over the U.S. Bank. 3 years later, a new Senate, recently elected, overturned that censure. So the censure is, you know, it's only happened once, and it was quickly reversed.
I appreciate that. Yeah, appreciate that perspective. Going to Mark, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you also, fellow listener, for asking the question, would the Senate be able to summon people to testify what would happen to them if they refused to come? This is a follow-up question. Who in the Senate is which body is in control of who gets called to testify? And are we likely in the Senate hearing to hear from the people whom Trump himself has prevented us from so far hearing from? Thank you. I'll take my answer off air.
Well, I think we're very unlikely to hear from those individuals. I mean, my understanding from the current discussions is that Mitch McConnell does not want to have kind of a full-blown trial with a lot of witnesses, or maybe any witnesses. And so I suspect what the trial might look like is arguments from the House managers, for the prosecutors, from the president's team, the president's lawyers, and the Senate would then have a vote on the articles based on that presentation, and that would be sufficient. So while theoretically the Senate could demand people to testify, and the same way the House can demand it as well. I mean, in theory, the House could send sergeants at arms to try to arrest people who don't comply with their subpoenas. It just doesn't happen, and I suspect it won't happen here either.
And a follow-up email from Paul. What happens if there is a dispute about the calling of witnesses? For example, if the House Democrats want to call witnesses, but the Senate Republicans block that, who resolves the dispute? David, do you know? The Senate Republicans. There you go.
Yeah, so the presiding officer of the Senate is really the manager of the process. So Mitch McConnell, in this case, would be the being the majority, would be presiding over this. So you would have him working with a team of people in his party to help manage. And then larger questions can be put to the Senate, and a simple majority vote could sustain that. So the presiding officer here has a great deal of leeway in this matter.
We're going to go to Bernie, from who's calling from Portland. Hi, Bernie. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Let me put this off speaker. I was just listening in. Hang on for a second. It's one of these things. There we go. The questions that I was originally going to ask about the role of the Chief Justice and about the jurors conspiring with the defendant to control the proceeding have already been touched on, but I did want to return to the hypocrisy demonstrated by Sue Collins and other Republican senators who will tell everyone that they can't comment because they are impartial jurors and then turn around and have lunch at the White House and talk to the defendant. My other question was, back to the Chief Justice, the Republicans in the House made a complete farce out of these hearings. And what's going to happen when the Republicans in the Senate do the same thing? Impromptu demonstrations, screaming and yelling, interrupting the proceedings. What do you think the Chief Justice, and does the Chief Justice even play a role in controlling the courtroom?
Dimitri?
Well, your question largely goes to kind of the point we just discussed, where, you know, when you have the majority in the House, you have a lot of control. And so there it was the Republicans who felt like their rights, they weren't being heard because the House, both the Intelligence Committee and Judiciary, had the Democratic majority. I think the situation will be different in the Senate when the Senate Republicans have a lot of control, and when the Democrats ask for certain witnesses to be called or for certain testimony to be heard, I suspect they'll be shut down there as well, right? And so I think it'll play out slightly differently. And I do think the Chief Justice's role is largely ceremonial. I suppose there could be objections that are raised, and the justice would be asked to resolve them. But it's still a political process, and the Senate majority would be able to basically decide on all of the controversial issues.
Oh, Jennifer, a couple of quick points, if I could jump in.
Yes, Kenneth, go ahead.
First of all, going back on a little bit again on the history, because we're talking about this politics, and when we think about those giants in Philadelphia in 1787, first of all, they didn't like politics, so they said. They warned against it, certainly, and they called it faction at the time. They also saw the Senate as, you know, in a kind of Roman noble virtuous sense. And there were always the thought that the Senate was going to be this group that would somehow wisely decide matters. I think there's a famous description of the Senate as the place where you would spill the coffee and blow on it to cool it off, so it's cooled down to tempers. And also, I should point out that the Senate, at the time of the writing of the Constitution, was selected by state legislatures, not by direct vote. That did not happen until the Constitution was changed in 1913. So the idea and the image of the Senate changed greatly in those 200 plus years, and I think that's one of the things we have to think of. Now, I understood from a few weeks ago that the senators themselves, to the caller's point specifically, would not be speaking during this procedure. That may not be accurate, and we may see how that happens if someone, you know, calls a point of order. I don't know how that will be dealt with, but I believe that the Senate Majority Leader said that the senators would not speak in this procedure.
David?
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, they do not, unless there are certain exceptions where that may be allowed. But to address it, this also addresses some other questions that we've had. The senators will take two oaths while they are in this process. The first is actually to remain silent while the House of Representatives presents the articles of impeachment, and that if individual senators have questions that they want answered, they have to write them down and forward them to the presiding officer in the group. So there is that sense of order. The second oath that they actually have to take deals with that idea of being impartial. And it simply says, I solemnly swear or affirm that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment now pending, I will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and the law, so help me God.
Bernie, so, thanks for your... go ahead, David.
So they do take those oaths, and this is very tightly managed, but it is still very much in the hands of the presiding officer.
Bernie, thanks for your question. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about the impeachment process. If you have a question, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Toad & Co., sustainable apparel and curated goods for the adventure that is life. Committed to living well and doing good in downtown Freeport, Maine. Float Harder Relaxation Center, dedicated to helping tired muscles recover faster through flotation therapy. Learn more at floatharder.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
When it comes to slowing climate change, let's face it, most people could do more.
We care passionately and score highly on measures of environmental concern. Yet, these beliefs do not necessarily translate into behavior on an everyday basis.
A scientist's view on why people don't adopt more climate-friendly habits, plus the latest news from Washington, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Voters across the region and political spectrum can agree on one thing. They care about immigration.
I think it resonates with people across the board because everyone's concerned with their own quality of living.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, a new poll of New Hampshire voters finds the immigration policies they care about largely don't affect them. And we'll hear from a historian who says U.S. cities owe their revitalization to Latino immigrants. Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding Impeachment. Joining me, Dimitri Baum with UMaine Law, David House with Husson University, and Kenneth C. Davis, author and historian. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. Dimitri, how do the charges that... President Trump faces compare with those President Nixon faced?
Well, President Nixon's charges, I think they're a little more closely tied to criminal statutes. So we saw a little bit more of, you know, obstruction of justice. And it was based on crimes that had been committed where the president was trying to use his power to commit other crimes. And we saw the same thing with Clinton as well, where the actual impeachment charges were more tethered to a criminal code, a criminal violation. I think all three of us seem to be in agreement. You know, somebody mentioned earlier that there's no requirement of a crime being committed. So, you know, the charges against President Trump seem to be a little less tethered to a criminal code and more tethered to kind of constitutional principles, right? Abuse of power. I mean, you know, some of the early impeachment with Johnson, for sure, you know, the focus really was on the president abusing his Article II power and kind of stepping on the toes of Congress and violating congressional statutes. So I see kind of fitting closely to the Johnson-Nixon impeachments, but being a little bit more at a high level than tied to elements of a crime.
Kenneth, anything to add to that?
Well, I would agree with everything Professor just said. And the trick is here that the Constitution does leave the House of Representatives this leeway. And I suppose it now boils down to which side you believe. And there has been significant evidence presented that this was certainly a crime in the sense of a federal election crime. And then there are also just matters of the tradition of a presidential candidate not involving a foreign power in our election, which, by the way, Nixon was accused of in 1968, but was kept very quiet. And Lyndon Johnson did not want to pursue it while he was president, because the election was underway. There was some question that Nixon had reached out to people through his friends in the Chinese community to the Chinese nationalist community to keep the Vietnamese from doing any kind of settlement of the Vietnam War. And this would, of course, change the character of the election completely. And that historically now has been supported by a great deal of evidence that Nixon had, in fact, done that, but it was not made an issue in 1968.
We'll go to Elizabeth calling from Mechanic Falls. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hi. So I guess it's kind of a question slash statement mixed together. But several years ago, I had a friend who was a victim of sexual assault by her uncle when she was younger. And he went on to abuse someone else. And she was subpoenaed to be a witness in the case. And she had called and explained that she wasn't comfortable doing this. And they said they could go ahead and make their case without her. But several days later, she was arrested for not showing up for her subpoena to be a witness. And I see, you know, our congressional subpoenas being ignored and no consequences whatsoever for this. Our own president going ahead and encouraging people to break the law with zero consequences and habitual lawbreaking. And then justification. And I just wonder, how is it that we become so incredibly imbalanced where we're willing to arrest a 19-year-old girl for not wanting to face her abuser, but we're not willing to hold people accountable to the oath that they made as public servants?
Dimitri, I think a lot of people have Elizabeth's question.
Well, and certainly one of the charges of impeachment here, one of the two, is obstruction of Congress, right? And it really is based on instructing witnesses not to comply with subpoenas and not to testify. I mean, I think, you know, the challenge here is that the House doesn't have a lot of great options, right? So you could go to court and try to enforce subpoenas and work through a process, which has happened in the past. Trump is certainly not the first president to decline to comply with subpoenas. And in the past, those have been negotiated and have reached compromise or have gone through the court process, which is slow and tedious and oftentimes has been used to run out the clock. The other option is to send a sergeant at arms and try to arrest folks. I think there's, you know, it's kind of seen as unseemly and kind of violative of the general process that we follow where you go to court. So it's, you know, the House subpoenas, while they have the same force of law as a judicial subpoena, I feel like the judicial subpoena is a little bit easier to enforce because you're already in court. And so the judge has kind of greater authority to do something about it than maybe the House itself.
Elizabeth, thanks for your question. I'm going to go to Peter calling from Liberty. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. There are two points I think I'd like to make. Is one, when they talk about high crimes and misdemeanors, I think believe, and I may be wrong, that the high relates to the office that is being held, that it's not severity of crime, but that it's a crime that is being committed from the high office, whether it be president or federal judicial. The other point I'd like to make is when the Senate votes, they're going to vote on two things, to my understanding. One is to remove the president from office or not, and two, to allow him to stand for election again. So conceivably, they can vote to remove the president from office, but still allow him to stand for election in 2020.
David?
That is correct. They can. The highest punishment that they can mete out is removal from office, and that's written in the Constitution. So actually, the Senate will vote on each article of impeachment because the House is presenting two articles in this case, and so the Senate will have a roll call on each one. And after that, the decision will be made, you know, okay, if they vote – hypothetically, if there were 67 votes that say yes, they find that the president has, you know, been convicted of this charge, they would then vote on the action of punishment.
And David, is Peter right that high crimes and misdemeanors, the high refers to the high office?
That's certainly one interpretation. That still is open. There are some differing arguments on that, but in many cases, yes. The idea is that it's attributing to or discussing the level of the office. And the the scrutiny applied to that office because of its high station.
Dimitri? Yeah.
I mean, if you look at what the framers talked about at the time when they wrote, I mean, it's a term of art. It comes from England, and the focus was on abusing your office, your official position, for personal benefit, to corrupt the government, to corrupt the Constitution. So, you know, I think it's a disputed exactly how to define the term, but I think there's a general agreement that it's an abuse of your office to achieve some personal gain rather than to benefit the nation and to act as a representative of the people.
Kenneth.
I would add to that, and I'm quoting from the New York Times, which has a word-by-word definition of impeachable in their pages today. And they refer to the beloved Alexander Hamilton of Broadway fame, writing that these are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse of or violation of some public trust. So it wasn't just the office of the presidency, obviously, but these are high offices that because it can be applied to any federal officer, the office is certainly part of it. And there certainly is broad agreement that an offense does not, as we've said already, need to violate a criminal statute to be impeachable. So this is, again, where it comes back to, I suppose, Gerald Ford's very practical definition that this is an impeachable offense is what a majority in the House of Representatives says it is at any given time.
Peter, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Robert in Buxton. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi there. I need a clarification. How do the Chief Justice and the Majority Leader of the Senate work together on leading the proceedings, or do they?
That's a good question. Any of the three of you know the answer? David?
Yeah. So the Chief Justice will be there acting almost like a trial judge would, so ruling on matters that are in order and procedure and everything else. The presiding officer of the Senate will help to guide whether or not there's witnesses, who gets called. Those things are worked out beforehand. And then when the trial kicks off, or I say trial in quotes, you can't see my air quotes, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will preside over this as an arbiter, as a judge.
Robert, thanks for your call. An email from Dave. Can the House prosecution call witnesses that it has subpoenaed previously, like Mick Mulvaney or John Bolton? Dimitri?
Well, this goes back to the point we discussed earlier about who's really in charge here. Right? I mentioned, you know, the House, the lawyers are the managers of the case, but they're more like prosecutors, right? So they basically decide what evidence to present when they're asked for it. But the Senate leader is the one who's really in charge of the entire process. And so the Senate decides by a vote that we're not going to have any witnesses. That's the Senate's decision. They can decide not to have a trial with witnesses at all. And if that's a decision, the House can't just say, no, we're overriding that. We're going to decide to call a witness.
A question from Jonathan. What is the possibility of the Senate impeachment vote being by secret ballot? There was some talk about that possibly happening, and the Senate only needing a simple majority to have a secret ballot take place. Do you think it's likely, David?
They can't. I don't know if that's likely. That all the other impeachments have been done by roll call vote. So it's certainly possible, because all they would need to do is to change the rule beforehand. But it's always a possibility. I don't want to try to predict the future. I don't see them changing too much about procedure going into this.
Okay, we're going to wrap up with a quick tweet. This is from Larry on Twitter. If removed, could Trump run again? Dimitri?
He could run again. Now, I think the Senate has the power to say you're prohibited from running from office, but it's certainly not unthinkable. And I think it's almost impossible to imagine a situation where you have enough senators to go along with removal. But yes, he could be removed and run again in next year.
And Ken, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to wrap up by asking you, what do you think is a common misconception about the impeachment process?
Well, I just want to add one note about the Chief Justice, that Justice Rehnquist in the Clinton afterwards impeachment said, "I did nothing in particular and did it very well." Now, he actually did make some procedural rulings, so that's not quite accurate, but I thought it was a nice punctuation mark. And I'm sorry, what was your question exactly?
You know what? That's okay. It was about misconceptions, but we're out of time. And you know what? This was all so interesting. We could probably talk for hours on end. Thank you all. The voice you just heard, Kenneth C. Davis, best-selling author of Don't Know Much About History and other books. Dimitri Baum, constitutional scholar and interim dean at UMaine School of Law. And David House, associate professor of history at Husson University. Lucy Suchek ran the board. The theme was composed by Mike Jandreau. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.